You're listening to a podcast from Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, which airs every Monday at 2 p.m. on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with award-winning author Jane Hamilton, whose new book is the excellent Lombards. Jane Hamilton is the author of The Book of Ruth, winner of the Penn Hemingway Award for First Fiction, and A Map of the World, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year, and named one of the top 10 books of the year by Entertainment Weekly, Publishers Weekly, The Miami Herald, and People. Both The Book of Ruth and A Map of the World have been selections of Oprah's Book Club. Her following work, The Short History of a Prince, was a Publishers Weekly Best Book of 1998. Her novel, Disobedience, was published in 2000. And her last novel, When Madeline Was Young, was a Washington Post Best Book of 2006. Jane Hamilton lives in and writes in an orchard farmhouse in Wisconsin. Here's a little information about the excellent Lombards. Mary Frances Frankie Lombard is fiercely in love with her family's sprawling apple orchard and the tangled web of family members who inhabit it. Content to spend her days planning capers with her brother William, competing with her brainy cousin Amanda, and expertly tending the orchard with her father, Frankie desires nothing more than for the rhythm of life to continue undisturbed. But she cannot help being haunted by the historical fact that some family members end up staying on the farm and others must leave. Change is inevitable, and threats of urbanization, disinheritance, and her own rites of passage soon shake the foundation of Frankie's roots. Frankie is left struggling to answer questions that have always haunted her before time overtakes the Lombards. Who will take over the farm for the next generation? What would it mean for her family to abandon its birthright? And does leaving home mean losing a part of yourself? When I spoke with Jane Hamilton, I began by asking her to read from the excellent Lombards.
We were making hay. Everyone who was there still remembers it, how the sky was its usual high, immense self. And as we went along, a wash of clouds moved in, the ceiling suddenly quite low. There was the usual sweet smell of hay drying, the swallows swooping and scolding, and the oil and dust of the baler, a bitter black fragrance. It had been windy and hot when we started, but the heat stilled, dirty and wet, or that was us at least. Chaff stuck in our mouths, chaff in our bloodshot eyes, chaff like sequins on our clothes, our flesh. My father wore what were originally his dark blue coveralls, the material over his back bleached by the sun to a pinkish white, the fabric drenched and glued to his skin. He didn't wear an undershirt on hot days, so you could see his thick chest hair, which always surprised me, that wet black fur. He had a wild, foamy look, a person not to interrupt, no saying a word or crossing his path. My brother William was there, and our very distant cousin Philip and the Burschick twins from down the road, and our hired hand Gloria and me and Aunt Mayhill, we called her, across the wide field on the Ellis Chalmers, the baler spitting out the old-fashioned square bales.
Thank you so much for reading that. And the chapter goes on from there, and it gets increasingly intense as the pressure of the weather is building, and you spend time, you introduce a number of new characters, as we just saw, including the narrator, Mary Frances, and you allow us to see through her eyes how heroic her father is to her. Mm-hmm. But the other thing I noticed was this scene felt very, it almost felt Old Testament biblical to me. anyway, I wondered if you could talk about writing this scene and if you remembered writing this chapter.
That's sort of the funny thing about writing a novel is that it's so preoccupying, and then afterwards there's, at least in my experience, there's a kind of amnesia. But so I knew that the book would always start with that scene, and as I wrote it, I came to understand how, in a certain way, that scene is the glue of the book, because it appears in the end as well. But you know, as most writers are, I too am a I guess a vulture, and my son actually told me that story. I wasn't there for that particular event. I do live on a farm myself, and we do make hay.
Right.
And so several years ago, he was remembering that scene, and it was important to him. And it, you know, it was just, it was so vivid the way he told it. And it was, and it did seem biblical in a certain way. And there was that aspect of the veneration of the father. And, you know, I'm sorry to say, I just thought to myself, I gotta have that.
That's mine. Well, actually, that's where my next question was going. I know that you are married to an apple farmer, and I wondered, when you're writing this close to home, is it tempting to include stories from your life, and do you also struggle to protect your family from your own creative impulses?
Oh, that is such a good way to phrase that. Well, here's what happened. I had been writing badly for many years, and out of a sense of anxiety about the end of what seemed to me at that time, the end of publishing, the end of writing, the end of books, the end of me, and because I'm approaching 60. So I just was kind of writing with the hopes that I could have one more book. And, you know, people gripe about the New York gatekeepers, but I'm very grateful to them for saying no, 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 even as painful as that is. So anyway, at one point, I had a conversation with my agent, and she said, I don't know why you don't write about that farm where you live. It's so interesting, and you should write a memoir about those people, and you've lived there all your adult life, and you came from the city, so you et cetera. And I said, well, I have no interest in writing a memoir. And she said, well, write a novel. And I said, I can't. I have to wait until the relatives are dead. And she said, well, you'll be dead too. So that made an impression upon me. And, you know, I thought, how can I really use this material, which, as you say, is so close to home? And, you know, I think all of my books are autobiographical in various ways, and many of them in ways that only I would know where to find that personal history or the little sparks that started it. But this one, certainly, I used my family's plot of land as a point of departure and used sort of basic outlines of characters also. But it's, you know, it's certainly not them.
Right.
But I know that, you know, I felt very conscious of bringing a certain amount of tenderness to the material, not too much, you know, but a certain amount. And you know, the truth is, when you're writing any character, you just have to leave so much out.
Sure.
So then there's the choice, you know, what aspects of the personality are you going to include? And also, because you're shaping a narrative, you have to throw things in that might not exist in real life, such as money issues. I mean, the money issues that Mary Frances's mother feels are not, and I am in the role of her mother.
Okay.
I, Jane Hamilton, am. But I, you know, we're very different also, and I don't have that bitterness about money that Nellie Lombard has.
Right.
So it's a little disconcerting, of course, because people think, oh, that Jane Hamilton must be very bitter about the money on her farm. But, you know, if you try to unmix what is fact and what is fiction, it is like trying to unmix paint.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, it's a very delicate, tender thing, and I could write a whole another book that would be the same story, but from a different perspective, that would tell different things and would use different facets of my so-called life. Mm-hmm. And so that would be different. I mean, for me, the challenge was how to organize all of this material. And I did not want to write a, you know, 3-volume generational saga. I wanted to write more of a poem, actually, and really focus the vexations and problems of succession into the body of that girl.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting. that you chose, I was going to ask you about this, you chose for your narrator a young girl. She's not a tiny child, although there are stories from her childhood, but she's conveying a fairly complex story of money and love and competition and legacy, all in this sprawling family farm that's owned by a large extended family. So I wondered if you ever found it hard to convey all that you had to show us all through this child's viewpoint.
I did. I wrote a lot of drafts, and you know, the book had started out as maybe a 550-page tome, and so it was a challenge to distill all the issues, you know, of particularly of succession, who in any family business, there's the issues of who gets to stay, who can't stay.
Right.
Who stays but isn't really equipped to stay, who comes on the scene and then is forever not regarded as the person who truly belongs.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tried to wrap that all into her thinking, and also thinking a little bit about what had come before, the ancestors. You know, she chronicles their settling the farm very briefly, but then says, we were really not very interested in the past. Really, our focus was on the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I loved that scene where she's getting some of the family history from Aunt May Hill. That was, and then she totally changes everything in the paper she writes for the teacher. That was wonderful. Sorry, I know that's not what you were talking about, but I just really enjoyed that.
Well, that was fun to write. I have to say that when I was first writing the book, in terms of length and the problems of distillation, you know, I knew that I wanted to use the farm and these characters and so forth and so on. But you know, we all watch so much terrific TV that have all these series have amazing plots, and it's so fun to see how the writers are going to get out of the pickles they've put themselves in. And so I did have this crazy plot that I overlaid over the material originally, which involved two mommies moving to a neighborhood near the farm, and they adopt this nun who has escaped from her monastery, and then she disappears and the children find her dead in the marsh later. You know, it's just completely ridiculous. And I learned a lot about Catholicism in that time and did a lot of research. But it took me, you know, about a year and a half to cut all that way away and to realize that there's still value in a quiet story about a girl who has a lot of sorrow about the mystery of time passing.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, because, you know, we read novels by writers who we admire, and we think, this is like scripture. This is the book. And, you know, you don't think about all that might have been changed as the author was writing, and all that the author went through trying to find that story that should be on the pages, you know?
That is true. That's true. I have an editor friend, and whenever I complain about a book that I think isn't as good as I thought it should be, mm-hmm. she'll say, "You just don't understand. It could have been so much worse." and you know, the editor, and I, you know, I'll say, "Why didn't the editor do it?" And she said, you have to understand, the editor may have done as much as she possibly could have done to make it as good as it presently is.
Right. Yeah. Well, it sounds like you've had some wonderful luck and advice, because you're a person who I could imagine editors might just say, "Fine, whatever you want, Jane," because you've had success in your career.
Oh, I would hate that.
So it sounds like you've been very fortunate. Yeah.
That would be so terrible. I hope that. Yeah. Oh, that just really sent a chill through me. I have a friend who is a writer, and well, you might have heard of her. Her name is Miss Ann Patchett.
Oh, yes.
And she has read her books to me, the last three, I think, out loud, and she wondered if I would like to read this book to her. You know, it was still in progress, and so I drove down to Nashville, and it took about 11 hours over the course of 2.5 days, and she listened to every single word.
Oh,
she
great.
Was the most amazing listener, and she basically edited the book as I read it to her, and she'd say things like, "You know, that sounds like what an adult would think a child would think, but not actually what a child would think.
That's
she
perfect.
Was astonishing. It was so great. And, it wasn't at the level of the semicolon, but almost, she would say, you've just got one word too many in that sentence.
Yeah.
So I am eternally grateful
wow,
to her.
That's amazing.
It was very scary, too. I had a stomachache the entire time because she's so smart and insightful. And, what if she hated it? That would have been dreadful.
I had the opportunity to interview her for this show, actually, and she was so lovely and generous, but I had a stomachache before that, too. You're listening to Write the Book radio show and podcast. Today, my interview is with Jane Hamilton, New York Times bestselling author of A Map of the World, and the book that we're discussing, The Excellent Lombards, a novel published by Grand Central Publishing. I hope you're enjoying the interview. I wanted to ask you about point of view and tone. Mm-hmm. At one point, in reaction to something William has said, the narrative tells us, he was the funniest boy in the world. And there was this exclamation uh-huh. point. And it's so in Mary Frances's viewpoint that this sentence is out there. And then, just as the opening scene, when we see her father as heroic, we get a better understanding about her, but we also learn about her family. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about instilling her voice or narrative voice generally within the narrative.
Well, that's always a tricky thing, and to talk about, and also to get it as right as possible mm-hmm. on the page. But two books were important to me in my thinking about this. The first was During the Reign of the Queen of Persia by Joan Chase. That book was in the third person plural. She used the we.
Okay.
And I remember when I read that book, I don't know that I'd encountered that before. It came out in the early 80s, mm-hmm. 1980s. I was thinking of that because Mary Frances does, there's a lot of, we did this and we did that. She's very bound to her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that part of the point of view. And I was also thinking of the book A Member of the Wedding by Carson McCullers.
Yeah.
That's a perfect novella, and the heroine is named Frances. I don't think high school students, I'm sure, don't read it anymore. And if they did, they would wonder why she wasn't prescribed any number of medications because she's so deranged and depressed and violent and out of control. And I remember thinking, I want a little gene from Frances in my Mary Frances. Some of that fierceness and just bewilderment about what is going on around her and an almost deranged love for her family.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking of both those books as I was writing the book. I've always loved the point of view of the child because it's just, there's such a point of tension in feeling a certain power, but also knowing that you're completely vulnerable mm-hmm. and powerless,
mm-hmm.
and everything around you is sometimes bewildering, and also terrifying. So there's so much tension, and it's a great space to inhabit, especially if you're not actively in it at that point.
Right. Yeah. One thing I really loved about the book was you convey so well sort of the comings and goings of people who are related to the family or the orchard or the work that they do. And one of the characters is Gloria, who's a young woman who helps manage the orchard, and she's like a member of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this point at which a cousin arrives, Stephen, and they're getting to know each other. And Stephen, we learn through Mary Frances, Stephen likes to talk about himself. but when he meets Gloria, he's different. They're clearly attracted to each other. And do you mind if I read a few sentences?
No.
The narrative sort of matches what it describes here. So, and yet with Gloria on their walk that day, he was waiting for her to say her part. He was listening. He said a sentence or two, and then she spoke. Neither one was confused or struggling. And it goes on from there. And I just felt like the narrative pacing was imitating what was actually happening on the page. The repetition of the word waiting made me feel him waiting. The single sentences back and forth, I thought, imitated the back and forth of their conversation. So do you work toward that kind of pacing, or does that just sort of happen naturally because you get into that moment as you're working?
Well, I love that observation, and I like to think that I was conscious of it, but I probably wasn't.
Okay.
but I do think it's very important for any writer, and I when I have students, I try to get them to read the work out loud to themselves in their own company, not in a whisper, but you know, out loud in the room they're in, because I think hearing it is very important, and I think that when you hear those rhythms, they're, you know, your instinct is at work, and so you might not know you're mimicking the event, mm-hmm. but you feel it and you hear it,
and it helps the reader, I think, to feel it as well, because all of a sudden everything changes. Everything's up a notch, or everything slows down a little bit. Our own experience of the narrative changes along with the action on the page. So.
Yeah, I think that's a very important thing to understand, that when there's high action going on, it is actually, and it's maybe a little counterintuitive, but to slow it down is often really valuable to convey what is actually happening and to give a sense, sometimes even of speed,
okay,
when you slow it down.
Yeah, interesting. And the example I chose was a kind of small moment, but it's just mm-hmm. what jumped out at me at that time.
Mm-hmm.
May I read a few of your descriptions, and then we can talk about describing characters?
Sure.
Great. So this is a description of Nellie, Mary Frances's mom. So much is very funny in this, too. Even if she hadn't been a nationally famous librarian, you wanted to loll around in her company because of her very form, her skinny legs and broad hips, her nice mid-size plush bosom, the gap between her two long front teeth, comic and also glamorous. And in addition to those pleasant encouragements, her brown eyes were soft with what seemed like sincerity, which was interesting. And then her teacher, Mrs. Kraselnik. Mm-hmm. I looked at my mother and back to the woman with the thin pliant lips in a fresh light plum shade, the tenderly etched lines by her large blue eyes, her softly glowing skin, the peach tones. There was sweetness itself, but sweetness tempered by the tang of her voice and her erect bearing. Mrs. Kraselnik, the horsewoman of summer fruits. And then finally, this just is a small thing about Aunt Mayhill, and I just loved it. Mayhill didn't have a lisp exactly, but there was a slushiness when she hit an S or a th, which no one ever mentioned. She lifted a pair of glasses that hung around her neck by a shoelace, set them on her nose, and began to read so quietly we had to sit forward. So can you just talk a little bit about, clearly, or it seemed to me, that you like to describe your characters. Mm-hmm. You like us to have a little picture of them.
Mm-hmm.
So do you work at that? Do you watch people in grocery stores and make a note when they have a shoelace around their neck? Or how does that come to you?
Actually, I think the shoelace was a contribution of Miss Ann Patchett. I grew up and in college was just, I spent a lot of time reading the Victorians, George Eliot and Dickens, and they you know, those descriptions of those characters are bliss.
Mm.
So that always seemed like just a way to enjoy your own powers as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think you can convey so much about character through, you know, a simple description or, you know, two or three lines that is kind of a shortcut into that character. So I think it's important to take the time to draw the characters as well as it's being a pleasure. I've been reading Louise Erdrich. She
mm-hmm.
has a new book,
yeah.
And reading The Roundhouse that came before, and she is a master at that, and it's really fun. I think, you know, I can feel her pleasure in seeing the person and putting what she sees on the page, and it's, her descriptions are funny too.
Yes.
And, you know, the one of the other pleasures of writing is probing the mystery of personality, as Flannery O'Connor wrote. And again, if you can get at the surface of the person, that often leads to the interior.
Yeah. When I'm reading, I want to see the person, and sometimes I'll superimpose an image if I don't get one from the author, but I really feel like the author should be the one who does that, right?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there was a period in the 80s when people were writing more minimally, but I go back to Edith Wharton sometimes. There's this description of a character named Mr. Racy in the old New York stories, and it literally is a page, and it describes his body to an agricultural estate, and he's huge, and he sweats a lot, and it's as if the sweat is making runnels down his body, as if it was, you know, a ditch on an agricultural in his estate, and a point of drainage. And it's just, it's so funny, and it's so over the top, and yet you have a perfect picture of him.
Yeah. One other description that I loved, for what it conveyed about writing as well as just the description itself, was of Pam Gretschke, a member of the town board. She is described as a woman with prickly short hair who bred Dobermans. And then in the next sentence, Mary Frances observes, "My father didn't usually imitate people, but when he performed Pam snapping her gum, we always suddenly realized that he was the funny one."
Mm-hmm.
So we get her gum there and not as part of the initial description. We thought we already had her, and then you added the gum, but also added to our understanding of Jim.
Oh, that's nice. Well, I do remember that line about the father imitating Pam came in very late.
Yeah.
It was in the kind of the penultimate draft.
Because it's late in the book too.
I realized at a certain point that I wanted him to have a moment where the kids perceived him as funny.
Yeah.
And so that was a place where I could make that happen. But it took me a while to get to that.
Well, and the other thing that was so perfect about the timing of that is he, in the town meeting, he is so measured and so straight, and just he wants fairness, and he wants to be a kind presence, I guess, I don't know if that's the right word. But, you know, mm-hmm. so it's this really interesting place to put that in fact, every once in a while, he does perform Pam, and he's funny.
He's snarky.
Yeah, he can do that.
He can be snarky.
I loved his relationship with Nellie, too, that they laugh together, and that they laugh when they're arguing. What a wonderful, mm-hmm. you know, what a wonderful couple, and Mary Frances is so much luckier than she knows.
She is. She's a bit hard on her mother.
Right. So I wanted to ask you, at one point Mary Frances talks about Aunt May Hill, and she's been described by some as a misfit, and her father says that's a cruel word, and no one should ever be mm-hmm. called that. And so I wondered if you can talk a little bit about writing, channeling characters who say cruel or politically incorrect things. So, for example, you have a speech impediment in the book. There's alcoholism, there's the word misfit, there's the word retarded. When you're writing a character who might do or say something that you wouldn't do or say, do you anticipate a certain amount of blowback from readers, or do you not think about that while you're writing?
I really try not to think about it, but of course I do, because we live in very dangerous times,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's so much... People are so free to say, to be offended.
Mm-hmm.
But this is how people speak. And I mean to render, the characters as truthfully as possible.
Right.
But also, I remember, I think it was in, it might have been in the Book of Ruth, which is my first book, and there's a moment where there's some deaf people, and I got a couple of letters about that, and so it's tricky,
right?
But one of the things that I feel glad about in this book is that there's almost no swearing, so that's an accomplishment, right?
Well, and you do.
No, I really thought hard about using the word retarded.
Yeah, well, and you...
But Mary Frances does say, yeah. You know, I know we're not supposed to say this.
Right, right. And you know, and her father says misfit is a cruel word, and you make it very clear retarded is not a word that is a kind word. You know, you give, mm-hmm. yeah, you mm-hmm. give them that.
Mm-hmm. Which is, trying to have it both ways. So I was very conscious of that.
I do think you might hear from middle-aged librarians in seasonal appliqué sweaters, though. That was great.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I know. You're going to hear
from them. I'm very worried.
I'm sure they have a lobby.
I have to say that I'm doing an event tomorrow night in a library in Illinois, and their cart drill team is doing performance before my speech.
Is that a thing?
Yes. I could not have invented that. I have no imagination. Actually, no, it's really a thing, and there really is a competition at the American Library Association convention every year.
That's just awesome. I loved that. Was another great scene. You chose to title each chapter, and I wondered how that uh-huh. came about. Was that your idea? Was that your editor's suggestion? I liked the titles, and I thought that they enhanced Mary Frances's presence. You know, they were very funny.
Well, I've never done that before, and I've also never written a book that is episodic, that's not mm-hmm. quite linear, and so I felt that the chapter titles were important to kind of set the stage and to hold the chapter in a certain way. So that was just something that at the beginning seemed like a natural fit, and I actually... I kind of enjoyed naming those chapters, but I wouldn't necessarily do it again. I mean, I might. You know, the funny thing about writing novels is that nothing that I've done before prepares me for the next thing. So each book requires its own form, and figuring out mm-hmm. what that form is going to be. I have a friend who's a genre writer. She writes police procedurals, and I just think, although I know it's really hard to write those books, I don't take anything away from that accomplishment. There's also a form, and there's certain things that you have to have that, you know, establishes boundaries, the victim, the accomplice, and so forth and so on. And I think, you know, if you're writing what is called a literary novel, you really do have to invent the thing each time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the chapter headings were important just to my conception of this book and how I could maybe make it a little looser than my other novels in terms of how linear it had to be.
Right. Okay. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the passage of narrative time. The thing that made me ask this question is Mary Frances's first camp experience is a full month long, and it takes a single page. So clearly we didn't need to know a lot mm-hmm. about what was happening mm-hmm. there. But mm-hmm. on the other hand, an hour can take a whole chapter. So if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Well, that was a real challenge. And I felt that, you know, I did wonder about that. Do I have to say more about this camp thing? Do I have to spend more time with her in high school? You know, because high school is such mm-hmm. a rich, full experience and could take up many, many volumes. But I tried to stay focused on her preoccupation with the farm. That camp thing did get whittled down. And yes, as you say, a lot has been left out. So...
But I didn't think wrongly so. You know, like I thought your school focusing on Mrs. Kraselnik, who's this person it's like the first person she ever falls in love with, and focusing mm-hmm. all her school lengths there seemed totally appropriate. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel that as I've gotten older and have written more novels, I'm much more interested in what's left out uh-huh. and leaving things out. Willa Cather has this great, and I'm not going to be able to quote it absolutely directly, but she says, it goes something like this: the great trick of the artistic spirit is to cut away everything that isn't necessary and yet have it remain in the reader's eye and ear as if it were there.
Oh, interesting.
And so that has been, as I've gotten older, has been kind of a guiding light
Yeah. Now, for a while in the early part of the book, there's a little competition going between Mary Frances and her cousin Amanda. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that would become a larger part of the story than it did in the end. Mm-hmm. Again, here's the author grappling with what's the story that she's telling. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you ever played around with that becoming a larger part of the story or if it was never meant to be that.
Oh, I did. I did play around with it. And in fact, in one of the, you know, billion drafts I wrote, we see those girls as women, and they are meeting as adults, and they have their professions and so forth. And again, I realized that I just had to limit the narrative to a very specific time and to end it before then, because this has just gotten out of hand. So Amanda was a larger part of it, but again, I used her for my purposes, and then she goes off into her own life, her own high school life.
Right. Well, and the other, she's not interested in running the farm, and that's really Mary Frances' focus. And so it's almost like once that they have this shared goal of winning this contest, and mm-hmm. that creates a competition, but also a camaraderie between them. But once they don't have a shared goal anymore, I thought it was quite appropriate that Mary Frances wasn't really thinking very much about Amanda.
And also, she is a year younger, so that's a huge golden time for a girl.
Now, are you working on a new project? And do you talk about new projects?
I have been trying to resuscitate something that was a failure in my years when I was wandering in the wilderness. So, I gave up on this book several times too, and yet I knew there was a story in it that I just had to find it. And I'm having a similar feeling with something that I put away a couple of years ago. So I don't know if it'll work out, but we'll see.
Okay. All right. And then I also was going to ask if you, and you have mentioned a number of books, which is great, but have you read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners?
I really loved the novella called Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift.
Okay.
Just read that. I thought The Little Red Chairs by Edna O'Brien was great. I read all the Eleanor Ferrante, the books, and have you read them?
I've read one of them. I haven't gotten to the next one yet.
So it's the quartet, starting with my brilliant friend, and I've had the occasion recently to be reading the last one out loud to my sister, and I'm freshly amazed. I can't believe it, speaking of concision and distillation of the material. So that is, you know, I started My Brilliant Friend when I was at a low point thinking, oh, there's nothing here that's going to interest me. You know, sometimes you go through the doldrums with reading itself, and I picked that up, and I just thought, oh, the novel will endure forever because this pleasure is so keen that why would we renounce it? So I'm grateful to Ferrante for that and for those
books. Whoever she may be.
For whoever, yes, and may she be anonymous forever. She's so smart to have withdrawn herself from the equation. And let's see, what else? I loved My Name is Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. I thought that was, you know, every now and then you read a novel and you think, oh, a novel can do that.
Yeah.
It can do this, that, but it can also do that. And so that was a beautiful experience.
Right. And talk about, like you said at the beginning, a quiet story. You know, there's still a place for a quiet novel. That was a pretty quiet novel, but wow, it was so great.
It was. As it is. So those are my most recent faves.
Wonderful. I just have one last question for you, Jane.
Yes.
I enjoyed some of the little celebrations they had. They have Blossom Day, and then they have Pumpkin Visitors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed those. Do you mind if I again read a short section, and then we can talk about it? This is during Blossom Day, which is in the spring, and Nellie gives Mary Frances and William the day off from school. She lets them stay home from school on the day that the blossoms come into the orchard. And so I just want to read this little bit and then talk about it. We had our books, the chessboard, cheese sandwiches, oranges, a thermos of lemonade, ginger snaps, trail mix, the usual goods for an expedition. William had his current Capsella robot masterpiece, half-built, the motors and wires and bolts in his toolbox. But soon into our encampment, it, or we, started to feel strange. We'd already stood close to smell the lacy petals. We'd lifted our faces to the sunshine. We'd talked about maybe playing pioneers, building a fire, roasting our own sandwiches on a stick. We'd discussed constructing a fort with levels in the tree this time, a few different stories. We'd said how maybe we should take a canoe. Somehow, though, those old amusements didn't seem interesting. Had they ever been interesting? And then a little farther down, we weren't just bored with the world. We were bored with ourselves, or we were hardly in ourselves anymore. It was hard to tell what was going on. Maybe if we could remember one little trick about how we used to be, we could get there, get back, as if ourselves were a country we'd left. I just loved this depiction of them growing up and growing out of their beloved childhood tradition. It felt real and honest and right, and I wondered if you could make a suggestion or some advice for bringing the reader into an important moment without melodrama or cliche, which I didn't think you did. But that was an important moment for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm always aware. I think I have a penchant for sentimentality, and I try to really guard against it for that easy, you know, that easy target of the tear ducts. So certainly, I remember when I was working on that passage, I just thought I can't take it too far into that realm of sentiment. But you know, all I can say is that when you're writing a passage like that, you have to listen hard to it, and you have to listen to what it is telling you. And I don't mean to sound woo-woo and new agey, but really, I myself don't know what I've made until I've made it, and then I have to look at it and see what it is. And I remember kind of having that experience with that passage, which I did work on quite a bit, just to try to get it as precise and as deeply felt without being mushy.
Yeah, and the precision, I would think, is very important, you know, the precision, getting all the details in, mm-hmm. you know, rather than a lot of flowery words about how they're feeling. Mm-hmm. There's his robot, you know, I mean, it's mm-hmm. just very specific.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a time and place to be very blunt about what a person is feeling, but there's also, you know, it's a balance between having the observations reveal what the character is feeling and also every now and then them just saying, you know, what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's sort of no one can really tell you what the perfect balance is. You have to figure it out.
And what's interesting, actually, in this scene, it's interesting that she's sort mm-hmm, of confused mm-hmm. by what she's feeling. And so that probably helps to keep it from becoming sentimental, because mm-hmm, she's mm-hmm. Trying to work it out, mm-hmm. too. Well, I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
I want to just mention again, the book is called The Excellent Lombards, a novel by Jane Hamilton, and it's published by Grand Central Publishing. Jane, thank you so much for speaking with me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for your careful and thoughtful reading. Thank you so much. That was really a pleasure to, you know, hear my words come back at me.
Thanks.
That was a real pleasure. So thank you.
That again was a conversation with Jane Hamilton. You can learn more about her work at her website, janehamiltonbooks.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is actually a quote. I ask that you consider the advice of Willa Cather as you work this week. Jane quoted Willa Cather during our interview, and here's the full text of that quote, which she was kind enough to share with me. It comes from Willa Cather's On the Art of Fiction. "Art, it seems to me, should simplify. That, indeed, is very nearly the whole of the higher artistic process, finding what conventions of form and what detail one can do without and yet preserve the spirit of the whole, so that all that one has suppressed and cut away is there to the reader's consciousness as much as if it were in type on the page." Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion.
Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by the farmhouse Burlington's Farm to Table Gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information, or come on down to the Burlington waterfront. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at bigheavyworld.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.